John Tang, it's not been that long, but since the last time we talked,
yeah,
I think was two regional wars in Asia ago. That's how I measure time, by how many little regional wars happen. And I think it's been two wars since we've talked. So how are you?
Yeah. I'm all right. Yeah. I'm traveling a lot these days, but
yeah. So usually we always have to clarify where it is in the world you are. Yeah. We used to have this game. I don't know if you remember it, but it's called "Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?" I think we should revive it, and we'll call it "Where in the World is John Peng?"
Well, it's a small circuit. I'm in yeah. Kuala Lumpur, or KL as we call it.
Very nice.
Out of the hotel room.
Yeah, glad we found some time, man. I don't really have much of like an agenda to discuss. I know you've got a lot of things cooking. And we were just talking about what's cooking. Some that we can disclose, some that we can't disclose. But you know, what are you thinking about these days? Are you thinking about America? We used to talk about America all the time. We used to do these spaces like the America Watchers and stuff. Is America still a relevant force in your world? Are you still thinking about America, or is it large? Are we moving into a post-America world where the Americans are starting to lose relevance? Because I really don't know, because I swim.
That's a very, very good question. Very interesting question to start with. I think America is, of course, a force, but in a different way, in an instructively different way. All the preoccupation here is with the U.S. tariffs. It's a force in terms of brute force. So people are worried about being punished if you do things that are seen to be, to be against U.S. interests, which today are very, very sharply delineated, right? I.e., don't do too much with China, you or Russia. So you come up against the U.S. as this sort of brute thing in the region. So that's unfortunate. It's no longer it doesn't inspire culturally. We're very far past that now. It doesn't inspire in terms of economic or cultural or political models, exemplars. Yeah, it's no longer, it has no soft power in that sense left.
Stripped down to the studs. We're just fucking nails and glue now.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And now it's wow. Very overt, right? Okay, if your tariff negotiations go a certain way, you're fine. Otherwise, you end up, slapped with 50% like India. You get singled out. It's thought of in that regard. The second space in which it's thought of course, is the slaughter in Gaza, and as being the prime supporter of that. So that's America in this region, at least viewed from Malaysia. I would say, I think the other dimension, the if there's a positive or just a neutral one, it would be, but even then, it's a bit of a worry. It would be in AI, in the space of AI. So there's enormous amount of buzz and hype around it. And I just came from an ASEAN AI summit here. So, of course, American companies, American LLMs, they figure here. But in the background of that are the technology restrictions. So every bit of U.S. presence is weaponized and divisive in a way that people here ultimately reject.
Yeah. Yeah, we're becoming the country that... I remember this old 60 Minutes report when this whole China tech paranoia first began. Mm-hmm. It was a report about how the U.S. was going to prohibit Sprint from buying Huawei telecom equipment. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I think it was a U.S. senator that was backing this. And he told the reporter, he said, because the reporter asked, why are you doing this? Like, why are you prohibiting Sprint from buying the equipment that it needs? Because Sprint was claiming that it can't find any replacement equipment for this. This is the only provider is Huawei. And the senator said, you got to understand, in China, the government, it's not like here in the U.S. The government can just tell companies what to do. No sense of fucking... It reminds me, I put that and someone said, hey, that reminds me literally the other day where Ursula von der Leyen is giving some, you know, she's doing some rally for freedom and democracy in Finland. And oh, someone interrupts her speech and the cops are literally pulled. And this guy was, I think he's a candidate for, you know, he's like a politician, you know, for like parliament there. And they're pulling him. The cops, like three of them are pulling him, grabbing him and forcing him out. They're going to take him away. They're arresting him. And Ursula von der Leyen goes, just be glad you're not in Russia, because in Russia, you'd get arrested.
There are these perfect setups, right?
Oh, my God. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah. No, in China, right, the government might sort of butt in and demand 15% of your revenue.
Right.
You know,
that was the literal number.
To allow you to sell semiconductors to a particular country.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man.
So what they can just come and, you know, ask for a kickback. Right,
it's incredible. It's incredible how Trump,
not a tax, not a tariff,
just a kick.
Just give me back 15%, and you can do it. Right, this is a security risk, but if you just kick me back 15%, we'll let you do it.
Also, make the checkout to Trump to Don Jr.
Don Jr.
He'll forward it to the U.S. government, but just make it out to Don Jr. Exactly. It will, yeah, he's our. Yeah, he's our treasurer now. I don't know, man. I will say, a report from the trenches here in the United States. I'm glad for you all over there that the U.S. is starting to become a fading horse in this, because You don't want to know what's going on over here. I do think that the situation here is getting quite bad. It's getting quite bad. The political situation is getting really strange. It's taking really weird turns. We're going into I wouldn't say it's all bad. I in the sense that I do think a lot of these things are necessary. But that doesn't, just because something's necessary doesn't mean that it's leading you anywhere good. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, the situation might have to get worse before things could possibly get better. And, you know, I think that all signs are pointing towards there actually is starting to be a growing popular resistance to Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also the Epstein thing is starting to be linked to Israel.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm starting to see that in the U.S. there is what is often called, what was called in Europe, a lot of people aren't comfortable saying this, but I'm Chinese, so I don't care. The Jewish question, I think, and they won't say it, because it's too, their people are too afraid to say this for good reason in the West.
Yeah.
But that is where politics seems to be headed. And if you pay attention to American politics from that angle, mm-hmm. you start to connect the dots. And there are good things about this, but there are also some scary things about this. So I don't know. I guess from the political view, I just, here in America, I don't know where things are headed, but like, you know, every day I'm just like, things are getting weirder and fucking weirder in the United States.
And this is a wedge, right? It's quite a wedge between the elite, the media political class, and everybody else. It's a very sharp wedge, the division in opinion, because everybody else has no reason to be so, pro-Israel. To be so fanatically pro-Israel.
You know what's the reason I say it's scary is I'm starting to understand the dynamics of this kind of thing. Is we are ripe for a class revolution of sorts in the United States. We're ready for that. I mean, hands down, people are angry, but there's never a spark that can set it off, right? The what I realized about the United States is that spark, the only thing that will spark that is if you can ethnicize the problem. If you can ethnicize the problem and convert the sheer anger of the American population is off the charts. I've never seen people this angry before about their stat. But it's a class anger. I mean, people are angry for the right reasons, right? Like they're angry because they can't afford anything anymore. They're angry because college is out of reach for people. They're angry because we've been talking about healthcare for decades and nothing gets better. And they're starting to put it together. And they're saying, why is it that we are taxed so much, but we don't get anything in return? But then you have all this money for Ukraine and Israel. And, you know, they're starting to put together, but people never rise up until you ethnicize the problem. That's why it's a little scary. Once you ethnicize the problem, then what happens is you get people who are primarily motivated by ethnic reasons. And so I predict there's going to be a rise in white nationalism here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So it's all connected. I mean, this whole anti-immigration, ICE raids, all that stuff, it's all connected. And it's starting to become a coherent populist sort of uprising, but it has a fascist feeling to it.
Yeah.
So I'm very cautious about what's going on here. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think in the US, right? That is a mobilizer. That a reliable mobilizer has been the ethnic and racial line, and this is how a class. I think what you're saying is this is how a class issue starts to play out.
I feel
like in U.S. fashion, right? Starts to go towards resolution, towards a bad resolution, but some sort of resolution.
Some sort of resolution. And it's very confusing because I think for those on the left, I'm increasingly more comfortable saying that I'm on the left because there's now a meaningful distinction between left and right. Mm-hmm. But whereas before it was like Republicans versus Democrats and conservative versus liberal. I don't really understand all that stuff. But now we're starting to see that there are two forms of populist sort of anger.
I see.
There's a left populism and a right populism, you know? And I'm more comfortable identifying with the left populism as a competitor, let's say, to the right populism.
Yeah.
But the right populism definitely just is more potent. And the people in the right they're much more willing to take risks and use force and say things without fear of consequences. And so
Do you think that is? I've puzzled over the same thing myself. I mean, this is part of the...
Because they know what they want.
Question of the useless, disappearing or useless left.
I think because they know what they want.
They know what they want.
They know what they want.
The way that the left doesn't?
Yeah. They know what they want. They want the restoration of white status. And they don't see why they're not allowed to have that. And I think, you know, as much as we criticize this, it's like I don't agree with it, but I do understand the argument that they raise over and over again, which is they're not right, but I get it. China is for the Chinese. Russia is for the Russians. It was until yesterday that Europe was for the Europeans, especially each of their respective countries. Why isn't America for Americans? And by American, of course, we mean white. We don't mean, you know, whatever. I don't agree with that. Obviously, I don't agree with that. History doesn't agree with them. But I understand. It's weird to... I can both I can both not disagree with what they're saying, but also understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, this is so important.
Yeah,
this difference between civilization and barbarity is the ability to make that distinction and to have that understanding.
I think people on the left are scared to admit, either they truly don't understand it, or they're scared to admit that they do understand it. But they, you know, it's there, that gives people, once they get convinced that something that was rightfully theirs was taken away, then that sense of like, well, I'm just going to take it back comes, and that's right populism is, I had something, it was rightfully mine, it was taken from me, and now I want it back. Whereas the left, you know, they're more mm-hmm. abstract in this like, we can be something better. And it's like, what's your vision? And there isn't a coherent vision, there's just a coherent anger. But the right has a coherent vision. It's revisionist, it's probably utopian, but they're convinced that it's real, that it was taken from them, and now they want it back.
Yeah, it's even it doesn't even have to be utopian. It's revanchist. They feel they point to the past, and there's something they want to revive.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if you look at the U.S. history, there's not a lot of great stuff to revive if you're a leftist, right? Except the fight, except the struggle. I think the left has seen better times. But the right points to something, maybe mythologizes it, and I think they can, they have this mythologized past. I don't know, 1950s.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Before the civil rights movement, that they want to bring.
Well, they're going further back than that, man. They're going to the 18th century. You know, they're going
further back than that. Oh, yeah.
They're going all the way back to the founding. You know, like they're going way back. I don't know. I guess I know these seem like separate topics, but I do.
No, it isn't. Not separate topics. I that's why I love talking to you.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I guess the part of me is I'm very curious, like, to what extent does the United? Because when I asked, the real reason why I ask is the United States relevant, is because I think eventually the relevance of the United States will be as a cautionary tale.
Right now it is. It already is out here. I have to bear the bad news. I wish it wasn't the case. I wish we had a more rounded, more positive impression of the U.S. But just don't underestimate the extent to which the image has fallen. It's just become where, you know, the glove has come off the mailed fist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is that a broad opinion?
I think that's very, very broad. I hang out here and I speak. So I have a good sense of what elite opinion is in, let us say, Malaysia, Indonesia. And that is, you know.
Really?
Yeah, that is the perception, okay? People remain polite and habitually deferential.
Do you think Israel and Gaza pushed it? Was that the sort of final straw, you think? Or was it?
Yeah, I think that is the disqualifying one.
Yeah.
That goes beyond the human, beyond anything tolerable. Okay.
So it may have been that the final load-bearing column of this whole imperial project was actually moral credibility.
Yeah, I mean, people underestimate that. Gone, right? People think that moral credibility doesn't matter. It's all about, you know, your
hard power.
Yeah, hard power, you know, violence, your aircraft carriers, right? Yeah, but a lot of political legitimacy rests on moral legitimacy, or at least the credible presentation of moral legitimacy, because every argument in a way rests on that. Even your truthfulness, you know, whether what you're saying can be believed or not, therefore your credibility rests on some basic attribution of moral legitimacy, moral credibility. I'm sorry, if you back a open genocide, you lose it. So So I don't underestimate the effect of that in the rest of the world. What more in the Muslim parts of the rest of the world, where they might identify more or feel more for people out there. But I think even in a place like that's really rather more pro-US, certainly US aligned, such as Singapore, the elites there, even if they don't, I'm sure many of them feel the moral horror of this. Even outside of that, because we have a lot of US style Christian fundamentalists there, even if they identify with this sort of Christian Zionism thing, I think they see incompetence, because that's the other thing. And they see lack of agency. Why are you doing this seemingly to your own detriment? In other words, as you mentioned, that Israeli Jewish Zionist question comes up.
Yeah. Yeah, it keeps coming up.
Because you look weak. You look You look terrible doing this. You look like you're not in charge and are unable to pursue your rational self-interest in international affairs. So when we deal with you, we're going to have to take that other thing into account.
You know, that's the thing that I think the way – I'm glad we're talking about this, because I really agree with you. I don't think these are separate discussions. They need to be connected with the domestic political situation here in the United States and the global.
And there's too little of that, actually. There's too little, you know, IR talk, as if the U.S. is just a black box, or power is black box, right? Realist talk.
Yeah. And to the great frustration of the realists, America is not behaving in a realist way.
Yeah, yeah.
Think that's where Mearsheimer doesn't convince me.
Yeah.
He doesn't convince me, because he's like, wait, if your theory is predictive, that's what he's saying. I just offer the truth. I'm just talking about how states behave. Then why are you so – I mean, he's just going around saying, I'm appalled at how the U.S. is not following my predictions. So is it normative or is it predictive? I think it's
normative. Well, if you ask him, okay – it's predictive. It's the closest thing to predictive. It's a model that works. But he also co-wrote The Israel Lobby, the book about the Israel Lobby. There is where the state does not behave in its realist national interest, because it has been taken over.
It's been taken over
by an external host.
Yeah. So, and this is a very
he's
start
honest
getting
enough
into
to go
that
there,
discussion.
Okay.
Yeah.
The great thing about debating him or talking to him is just a pretty brutal honesty
about
In his own
terms. I agree with that.
Disagree with his his
which I thought you met
assumptions.
Him. You just a picture of you with the guy.
Yeah, yeah. I met him. I nice. Sat. Yeah, I had a chance to sit over an entire dinner, with him. Next to me, and we talked quite a bit.
Was that in China?
No, that was in Budapest.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
See, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? Where is John Peng?
that was an interesting one. That's a very interesting setup.
You should drop little hints, I was eating a little Hungarian, I don't know what Hungarian pastry is called, but you should just name it, and then we can choose. Oh, he's in Budapest. Yeah.
So that one was very, very interesting. And he's a very, he's a very decent person, right? Decent man, actually. And just wrong.
Intellectually honest.
Intellectually honest.
Yeah.
Pretty, from my perspective, right? Pretty narrowly focused on something, right? And but still, one would have a really decent engagement with him. He would agree that you disagree. So there's no attempt to bully you or anything like that into his view. Okay. He knows where his theory falls apart. And it falls apart on this. I'm just imagining, if I had said this to him, he'd say, it doesn't work. My theory doesn't work on this.
Yeah. There was a great interaction between him and Jeffrey Sachs, I think, at the All In podcast. They have a conference.
Yes.
And they were discussing China.
Yeah, they disagreed with China.
Yeah, and Mearsheimer kept saying, if look, I'm just offering you the truth. If you look at how states actually work and how they, you know, how they pursue their state interests, the US and China are bound for conflict. And Jeffrey Sachs, I think, was like, why do you just say that? Why can't you just come out against this notion and admit that it's not necessary? Because economically speaking, that's bad game theory. You should cooperate. And I think that that was a very interesting distinction between someone whose head is wholly in IR. I mean, this guy is just like playing Risk all day, right? He's a geo.
He has a very basic set of really quite simple assumptions.
Yeah. Game of life type shit.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And he's not claiming that these are even empirical. So I pressed him a little bit on this, okay? Yeah. And I said, look, this is deductive, isn't it? It's not quite just empirical. It's deductive from a basic set of
axioms.
And those axioms are, and I asked him, they're Hobbesian, aren't they? And he said, yeah, they are. Basically, this is Hobbes in the international order. And it's, you know, I'm familiar with this sort of thinking from economics. These axioms work, and it's deductive. If you tell someone like this that, oh, you know, it doesn't quite work out, people are not actually like this, it doesn't really matter, because in the main, the model works. It all comes out in the wash because this deductive frame works, right? All the other things come out in the wash. They cancel each other out. And the basic argument is that we live in an anarchic order. There is no hegemon, there is no Leviathan over the international space, and therefore every state is just out there maximizing its security. If they don't, they become lunch. And, you know, and in his view, China, the way to maximize hegemony is to grow your power and dominate. To him, hegemony is to become the hegemon, as the US has, probably the first country, you know, to have global hegemony for a very brief period, if at all. That's the maximum security. I don't think the Chinese see the world like that. They don't think of it as a safe position. You
know? Right, right. They seem to be trying to back down from that wherever they can.
Yeah.
Maybe he is right in the sense that the Chinese seem to need to actively resist it. I feel like if they were to behave in a less... if they weren't consciously trying to resist this, maybe their actions would lead them towards that. You know what I mean? Like, they keep getting pulled into...
Their political culture tells them, if you go for this, it's like the ring. You go for this, you're going to collapse. This is a bad place to be, and you should focus inward. China is a inward focused civilization. But you have to understand, this inward is a universe. It's bigger than the entire Western world put together. For almost all of recorded history, this has been the largest polity. There's a reason how it managed to remain the largest polity and not become like Europe, a bunch of separate states, which it periodically falls into, right? So you want to understand how it is that in the world today, as a phenomenon, you have a state that large, a unified state that large, that has learned to be like that. You can only be that if you are really fundamentally focused on internal matters. Your struggles are internal, your fights are internal, your wars are internal, your challenges are. If you look at Xi Jinping's brain, right, how much real estate in there is occupied with internal issues, you'll realize. I mean,
you know, as much as
not his primary concern.
As much as I condemn the global Chinese diaspora as a member of said diaspora, and how much I despise the way that the diaspora identity gets formed while overseas, especially in the West, I will say that I get increasingly frustrated, and I think it's just this is my America brain, which is fundamentally what I am. Realizing this about China, what you said, it's a universe. That's exactly what my uncle told me as we were walking along the river together in Taiwan. He was like, Taiwan's a little peon thing.
Mm-hmm.
But China, he's like, it's not a country.
He said it's
Xiao世界. It is a
little world
universe. Mm-hmm. It's not a country. You can't think of it that way. And I was like, yeah, mm-hmm. I agree. I just came from there. It's pretty big. And he's like, no, it's a universe. I was like, okay.
Once you go in there, there are little countries like, you know, Zhejiang, Jiangxi, Guangdong, Henan. You have these little state like, things which, by the way, have existed longer than any European state, I would say. You know, the present system of provinces and so on is also very old. And yet they are not a bunch of countries, separate countries. They were at certain points. So this is a certain experiment in political order that is uniquely successful, right? At maintaining this type of order, and to see it as a nation state, as a country like Vanuatu or even Malaysia, is to fundamentally misunderstand its nature. And that's the realist thing. We're all just these black boxes in countries, Vanuatu, China, or India.
This is what makes China, I think, a little bit frustrating for outsiders like me, which is, the Chinese there's a stubborn character to the Chinese. They're stubborn because they have a very strong sense of what they want to do, how they want to do it. I think this is really what pissed off the diplomats and politicians in Washington back in the good old days in the 90s and stuff, even when they were trying to engage, was like, these motherfuckers are stubborn as shit. Like, they just won't.
Yes.
They will not open their minds up and become good fucking pupils of the liberal, new modern liberal order, which they will eventually have to be in order to be successful. They're going to have to get their fucking minds around how the world works. And this was the bet, I think, in the 90s.
This
generation will fucking die out, and the next generation will be smarter and more worldly, and then they'll ditch all these old Chinese fucking ways and their insularity. And they'll become members of the global community, and then they'll take out mortgages and they'll get cucked by JP Morgan Chase.
Yes.
And it didn't fucking happen, not the way they wanted it to. And I'm at a point where I'm trying to understand the outsider's view of China better. And because, like, look, it's so easy to be like, the West is shit and China is the future. I know it's, we know, let's just accept this.
Let's accept that.
It's fucking, like, that's not news anymore, man.
Okay. Not an interesting conversation.
Yeah. But what are the weaknesses of China now? Because I think they're stepping into a new realm
I want to pursue this question. Yeah. This thing that you mentioned. Uh-huh. I think this is a very charitable way of putting it, charitable on both sides, the U.S. and Western frustration, and the Chinese side's seeming stubbornness. I think on the Chinese side as well, it's not just that it's not malice attempt to deceive. It's a lot of the time, they simply can't. This is a perspective.
They cannot
come out of that, Xiao世界. Even in their interaction, the little world, little universe, in their interactions with foreigners. Okay. I'm telling you as another overseas Chinese.
Yeah.
Person.
Yeah. Okay.
I grew up in a milieu
hilarious.
In which you survive, you live and thrive by your relationships with cultural others. It's a plural society.
Yeah.
So you have to understand straight away, this is how a Malay person in general feels and thinks, right? How a Tamil person feels. I mean, these were my classmates. You'd have a good mix, a plurality, right, of these different, races and cultures in a class. So you learn very, very quickly to switch between and, as they say, switch codes. But understand different frameworks, different viewpoints on the world, and it becomes just natural. This is a huge difference between us, between, let's say, Malaysian Chinese or Southeast Asian Chinese and mainland-born, mainland Chinese.
Yeah.
Because they just don't have that experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big difference. I can understand how they feel. They don't quite know what it is to inhabit these different worlds. Not their fault.
Yeah, but the thing is, when this was pointed out, I think, you know who's like a really arrogant son of a bitch who I actually kind of like? Hmm. Is his name Eric X Lee? Is it Eric Shi or Eric Lee? He's like
Eric Lee, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he is.
I know the guy.
Oh, you know the guy.
Yeah.
He is an arrogant son of a bitch, but I like him. I mean, I like what he has to say.
He's a cocky guy.
He's a cocky son of a bitch, but there's just a certain inflexibility to how he presents this, yes. And it scares the world. It's like, all of you are fucked. The Western world is shit. Like it's going to call all, you know, and it's kind of like, bro, chill. Like, this is starting to sound very, he was like, do you know how difficult it is to rise in the meritocracy of the Communist Party of China? And like, just how tough, like, you know, and then you've got these cheerleaders on Twitter. And I'm very sympathetic to these people. I am, frankly, very, you know, as a Chinese person, I'm glad China is doing well.
Yeah.
But now I think China is so successful that I think it can afford to be, there's space for some critical reflection here.
I absolutely agree.
You know,
there's space for critical reflection, but there's space for also for partnership. Yeah. I think it actually has to begin with an understanding that they are different in that regard, with self-consciousness. Okay. And there's no need to try to pretend that you are not like this. It's just like for most Americans. They are like Americans in this regard. These Americans also inhabit a world. In fact, when they move around in a little bubble in which they for the last, I don't know, you know, 50 years or more, 70 years, they've managed to move around and that world follows them. The rest of the world conforms to their American expectations, right?
Yeah.
Around them.
Right.
So they too are like that, actually. Yes. But for different reasons. So the Chinese need to understand that they are like this, and that they actually don't have, I mean, even diplomatically, a lot of capacity to understand and relate at a deeper level. Okay. So in this, I think, to be fair, they share the same predicament as the Americans. So they need to come to an awareness of that. This is a space in which Malaysia, Southeast Asia, Malaysia in particular, has a role to play. We are the opposite of that little world, little universe. We have always been, people in this part of the world, have always been the guy in the middle, the connector. Just as China is the outcome, the product of that. If you look at China today, the reason why it's like that is that you had people fundamentally focused internally like that. I mean, I'm turning the question around, starting with the brute fact of the existence of this. How did it come to be? If you look at Southeast Asia, I mean, its entire basis, its civilizations, you take a look at some of the key kind of civilizations or the key empires that have existed here, they were trading empires, at least on the Malay Peninsula. They all existed as maritime. They were not concerned about, you know, the hinterland, how it was mapped. They were concerned about sea routes, about connections, right? And they were in the middle of these trade routes. These trade winds would bring ships down from the Chinese coast, the southern Chinese coast, down to the Malay Peninsula, where they would sit for a few months to wait for the trade winds to switch, to bring them up north, east, right?
Mm.
Up to the Indian Ocean. So you're this guy
through,
in the middle.
Through like Malacca.
Through Malacca. That's how Malacca exists. Malacca owes its existence to that. there would have been, it's not quite politically correct to say this, even in Malaysia, but people here actually, they understand this, okay? We don't have to talk about this too loudly, but it doesn't jive with this normal, you know, with nationalist talk in which every nation just rises out of nothing. There wouldn't have been a Malacca, I think, without the Ming maritime expansion.
Sure.
Yeah, it wasn't an expansion without the Ming Navy. Let's put it that way, right? Because it was, to a great extent, a Ming protectorate. And when the Ming decided, that's it, we're retreating, we're going back home because this stuff is not good for us, right? Malacca was left unprotected and fell to the Portuguese. That was the end of 17 centuries, actually, of an Asian-based trade order, in which it was not run by Chinese, by the way. The Chinese typically were mostly set back in places like Quanzhou, Guangzhou, Canton. And traders would come, Persians, Malays, Indians, right, from... And they will bring the stuff. So, this is an early version of a global hub. Yeah, it was already an early version of a global hub. So when Rome received silk silk was a big thing in ancient Rome, from China, it wasn't Chinese who brought it. It had passed through a set of hands, right? Many sets of hands. And it, so it's these people who did the mediating. So they have a role. So my contention for Malaysia in particular is, you know, this is our role. This is a role cut out for us in the world. Malaysia is a trading nation, by the way. It's one of the largest, you know, one of the top 20 trading nations in the world. Very, very much outward oriented, export oriented, but also trade oriented, just as Singapore is. And that kind of ability to mediate, to talk to the Chinese, to talk to the Indians, to talk to the Arabs, that's just in the political DNA, in the cultural DNA. And that's the kind of stuff we can do today.
You think that's what Singapore's sort of magic special sauce was, and Lee Kuan Yew suddenly becoming the sort of like wise man of the earth for his reign, and then maybe things are changing, I think.
Yes, Singapore's special sauce had a lot to do with U.S. supremacy in the region.
Yeah.
It had a lot to do previous to that with British primacy in the region.
Yeah.
Yeah. Singapore didn't rise out of, you know, there's this myth people like to tell, this little story about, you know, Lee Kuan Yew came along and this swamp land suddenly became, he turned this swamp into the greatest. No.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was the jewel in the British Empire east of
there's a lot of mythology behind it. I feel like there's tons of mythology behind it.
Yeah, national mythology around it. There's a reason why when the Japanese captured Singapore, it was the only place, right? My wife likes to point this out, right? That they named, right? They called it Shonanto.
Okay.
And basically annexed. They didn't come with the pretense of saying, look, this is, we're going to help you. We're going to help liberate you from...
They just wanted it.
From the British, right? Or the Dutch. Yeah. No, they wanted it. This was to be their light in the East. So, yeah, it wasn't, you know, as... It wasn't just some nothing place. It always was an important place. And yes, Singapore has a lot of that. Has a lot of that ability to mediate between cultures. People there have that. Maybe today they might have less of it because you had a very Singapore adapted to the American era and became very much a kind of base for American MNCs, etc. Right. And but yes, Singapore shares that.
You know, I'm looking at a map of Malaysia.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, the west coast of Malaysia versus the east coast are two separate oceans, right? Is it Indian Ocean on the west coast and Pacific on the east, or am I wrong?
Yeah, there are two. There are two halves separated by the South China Sea. there is a peninsula.
Oh, no, no. I'm sorry. I'm talking about, I don't know if you guys call it the mainland or whatever, but
yeah.
the peninsula. Malaysia.
Yeah.
The east coast of it, is that, that's...
That's that that border, that the east coast is
Pacific
faces no it faces the South China Sea.
Yeah, but is the, that part of the Pacific Ocean or?
Well, it's not considered. It's I don't know if technically it's part of the Pacific Ocean. But
I guess what I'm asking is, is it straddling two oceans?
It does straddle two oceans.
Okay,
it does. It does. It very.
That's another weird similarity to the United States.
Yeah,
if that's the case, I don't know if that's the case.
Yeah, between the Indian Ocean and the South China Sea is really part of the. I think that would be the dividing line. That would be part.
Yeah, I mean, I think the South China Sea.
If you want to talk about Indo-Pacific, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, Indo-Pacific. That's.
So
that's
it's an Indo, it's an Indo-Pacific. You had to cross to get from the Indian Ocean to the Pacific, to the South China Sea, right? Which is a kind of sheltered part of the Pacific. Because it has Borneo, right, to the west. Yeah. It's bordered by Borneo, the Philippines, and these islands, right? So that it creates a kind of a smaller sea. You want to get from that to that, you pass through either the Sunda Strait between Sumatra and Java, which is further to the south.
It's further to the south, yeah.
Yeah, further to the south. That's one access, and it takes you down to the southern, more southern Indian Ocean. Or you just cross in the more obvious way, the more coast-hugging way. In the past, right, you didn't have these ocean vessels. These vessels would hug the coast a bit more. You just go along the coast of what is today, India, Myanmar, Thailand, and Malaysia. And you come down the strait between Sumatra, which is Indonesia, and the Malay Peninsula, which is part of Malaysia. So that stretch of water.
And then at the end of it, you'll just see Singapore right on your left.
Yeah, as critical as the Red Sea or the Persian Gulf, right? It's to global trade, you know. Take a look at the map.
Are there a lot of port? Is there a lot of port activity in
the port activity Malaysia? Is in yes. There's quite a lot on the Malay Peninsula. In Malaysia, there is Port Klang, which is sort of midway. It's next to Kuala Lumpur,
right?
So that port.
Oh, I see it
for Malaysia. Yeah, you see Klang.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then further south, Singapore, of course, is that huge global hub of shipping.
Yeah.
But on the Malaysian side, east and west of Singapore, in the state of Johor, there are ports. Yeah. So there are ports that complement and compete with, to a small extent, what's going on in Singapore. Yeah. So can you imagine a place out there? You think that Stamford Raffles in the early 19th century decided to, essentially take over or buy the island from the Sultan of Johor. He did it for nothing. I mean, this is a absolutely strategic spot.
And they've known for a long time.
I guess
in a way that like the notion that Malaysia is becoming sort of a hub for the world, is a sort of return to its.
I think we're seeing a return. Yeah, the idea I like is a return to pre-colonial trade and even civilizational order, in which this part of the world, the archipelago, which includes Indonesia, was a crossroads between East and West. And I think political destiny is returning.
It really is a depressing idea that all of this shit should just be, patrolled by the Seventh Fleet. that the U.S. Navy, this is just like sort of a backwater area.
Yeah.
One of four or five major world control centers of U.S. power.
No idea. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so ridiculous and outdated. though I think we still live by, I mean, I still think delusional. The fumes of that idea.
Yeah. It's still, absolutely delusional.
It's so stupid.
Yeah. Don't tell us.
And we're going to use trade sanctions to try and reinforce this. And it's like, I think the sooner people can get over that idea, the sooner they can step through the threshold of like the past into the present.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And so a good place to step into the present.
Yeah, not the future. Malaysia. It's the fucking president. Yeah,
it's the present. It, yeah, it's the present in a very interesting way. It's a we started earlier to talk about this Chinese continentality. Let's call it in their entire political mindset, but also in the way they relate in their diplomacy and so on. This is not a criticism. This is about the nature of the thing. This is how they function. And they wouldn't function as well if they weren't that preoccupied with themselves, with the internal. And this to remember that the internal is a universe larger than the entire West.
Yeah.
Together, Japan included.
I mean, just management, so, just national management
is going to take
ridiculous.
Up.
Ridiculous. Yeah.
Ridiculously complex.
The scale is just insane.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you should be grateful that they're managing it well for the sake of the rest of the world as well. There's a role to play for Malaysia in the midst of this, right? In Southeast Asia. ASEAN is now China's largest trading partner, and that's just growing. It's not just trade.
I saw the bar charts of the trade. U.S. is a blip in terms of the export volume of China. Yeah. Like it's these trade sanctions ultimately don't seem to really bother. It's not going to really frustrate China that much.
When you're only a fraction of China trade, it's hard for Americans to understand this. The U.S. is of course a very important market and a tempting one, because no one spends like the Americans and no one ever will, probably, again.
Yeah.
Chinese consumers will never blow money the way Americans do, on debt, as it turns out. So, nor will Southeast Asians, but...
And nowhere else can you speculate in real estate with the total reckless abandon, as well as whatever the hell... I mean, the United States is just becoming a giant fucking Las Vegas.
It's a Las Vegas and an asset sale, right? It's about assets.
We're for sale. The country's for fucking sale, man. You know?
I think that's the nature of the formation of the U.S. too.
Yeah. It's the nature of the discontent in America.
Yeah.
Is how much this country is for sale. But it remains on sale. I mean, there's a lot to buy over here.
Nothing's changing anytime soon. That this is a country. In many respects, sometimes you can understand it better as some sort of corporation or some sort of exploration or land speculation enterprise, which it very much was at its founding, right? It's a settler enterprise, however you put it, right?
Like I said, the most salient fact about the United States is our short-term interest rate.
Yeah.
If you really want to understand America, begin with what the short-term interest rate is. Yeah. Everything will make sense from there.
Yeah. So then we come full circle to these white guys looking at a place like China and say, well, how come, Chinese have their country and we don't?
Yeah.
So you're setting up an expectation of yourself, for yourself, right? That the nature of this place is probably not going to fulfill. You're on the trading floor of some operation and you want this to be a country.
Yeah.
You're in an airport lounge, for example, and you're operating like a country. Yeah. And we all have this fiction of the world as, well, here are these countries, the post-1945 order, these are all equal, right?
Yeah.
And we need that as a legal construct.
We're all just a bunch of bros
sitting on this globe, man.
Yeah. And that's,
Yeah. Whether you are New Zealand or you are Russia, you're just the same, but you're not. And you need to make a distinction between that legal, political, and probably necessary construct and your actual political reality. And our theories don't talk about that. That's what's really missing, I think, from
Mearsheimer's view.
Yeah, it is.
Where he starts with the sort of blank, the sort of like generic class of nation state.
Yeah. As you can see, he doesn't even capture the US.
Yeah.
And that model developed out of post-Westphalian Europe. It's a very good description of Europe and of a region in perpetual war. It's definitely not a good description of China, East Asia, Southeast Asia. But then with, you know, as you would maintain, it's not even a good description of the US.
It's not. I mean, I think that's like, you know, that's the base of the political discontent here is like, hey, you know, like some of us are starting to realize like shit, like we don't really come from any, you know, like I think white people in America are starting in a weird way to become like an ethnic minority. They're kind of becoming a lost diaspora.
And
I've said this online, and white people, white nationalists get super fucking upset at me, which is how I know I'm kind of like hitting at some, like a raw nerve.
They say that themselves. They say that themselves. We're becoming a minority in our own country, right?
Well, yeah, but what I mean by that is like they're starting to take on the strange thinking.
The cultural
aspects.
You're starting to behave like that.
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, I've been this podcast originated out of a lot of, you know, just disgust at the way, you know, Asian diaspora even becomes a thing. Like that there is this sort of like yellow man from nowhere.
Yeah.
In America, and we write fake histories about ourselves. Mm-hmm. We didn't come up with this shit. I mean,
I don't even like the term diaspora. I would never describe myself as diaspora.
It's a strange term. It's a strange term. Maybe Huaren. I don't know, but that's limited to Chinese. Over here, we're all racialized, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's this sort of like. Man from nowhere, and we idealize this for ethnic minorities. It's like we're from nowhere. It's like we hit reboot. We lost all that old shit. We got to recreate what we are. And I think white people felt they were different in that they still maintained. They were like a clipping from Europe. They, you know, and they still maintained that European identity, but then it took root in the United States because they're like, look, we're not like you guys. We're not foreigners. We wholesale imported our culture. Or exported our culture to the United States, and then it grew up here. And so it's from the same European, you know, vine, right? Yes. Whereas you guys, you come over here, but you can't, you know, we don't allow you to plant your vine here. So, but now I'm starting to think that's not really true either. I don't even think the European identity was really allowed to fully take root here. I think we hit a hard reset. Maybe that's why they want to go back to the 19th century or 18th century when things are more directly connected to its European roots.
There's an argument that the US has become more anglicized to its detriment since the war, or actually over the 20th century, as it was dragged on, into two wars by Britain.
Yeah.
Or manipulated in two wars. There's that sort of argument out there. That before that, it was quite different. And self-consciously different, not just a graph, but a new thing, an American civilization, right? A white
American. There were certainly, I think there's long been attempts to try and define a distinct, a native, not Native American, but like distinct American.
Yeah.
And fact, frankly,
they took
Wright
the name Native. They refer to themselves as Native, right? They appropriated the indigeneity.
White nationalists natives, say, right? At this point, we're Native
Americans. When you say Natives, the word used to refer to the white settlers. But and this is important to understand because it's politically significant now in a more isolationist, non-interventionist streak, I would think, in the populist movements.
Yeah, because I mean, you never know what kind, like to understand how Trump works, like how his base works, what his interests are. You know, it's just really, because the U.S. is such a strange animal. However, and we talked about this on our last pod about Malaysia. I do think the United States is quite legible to Malaysians. Because, and we talked about, I think, some of the parallels even in our 20th century history, but the sort of like a relatively random assortment of people all around the world that were put into one place primarily by economic forces, and then were then sort of left with no instructions, but were left with existential stakes, the task of forming a national identity out of that random collection of people. That's what I think that both the U.S. and the Malaysia may have in common, that we got to do that.
Yeah, yeah. I think the predominance of race in everyday life and politics is one area that Malaysians understand, have to cope with. Although we deal with it in a very different way,